Well, we'll just try to get started without it. And welcome everyone to the Tangerine SDR get together on TeamSpeak. This is 20th through 25th for those who use Universal Time. Anyway, we'll get started here, I guess, with my comments. I did see something interesting a few hours ago. Gizmodo has a, if you follow that particular website, but generally to be fairly accurate in their predictions, they are touting the new Raspberry Pi, and I guess the probably better that everybody reads the little article that accompanies it. But the notable thing for me was it's going to be $35 for 1 gig of RAM, $45 for 2 gigs, and $55 for 4 gigs. Still going to have the x86 texture, which is probably a bit of a downer, but it will have USB 2 and USB 3, a gig Ethernet. Also, is going to get a little operating system. Use a ported version of Debian rather than what they're currently using. So we should have a few more libraries at least that are. Anyway, having said that, that's kind of my act here of the week. And I hope everyone had a great field day yesterday. Those who I did not, I guess yesterday, I really shouldn't say yesterday, but yesterday and Saturday. So anyway, we'll go ahead and get started here. Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, everyone. I'm just having, well, some oddness here, but been fooling around with the little magnetic sensor that I got. I haven't really got it completely set up yet, but I'm trying to get to where I talk to it and get some response from it. Probably have something to tell about that later on.
Did we lose you, Dan?
Okay, so I seem to have lost my audio here for some reason. I sure don't know what's going on, but something. Anyway, thanks, Dave. I didn't hear your sign-off. So next we have Mike, AAAK, listed as recording. And thanks again, Mike, for recording and posting our audio TeamSpeak session. We'll skip on to Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thanks a lot, Dan. I appreciate it. Good to hear everyone this evening. Sorry I couldn't make it last week. I was at the National Science Foundation CEDAR workshop in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and that's a coupling of energetics and dynamics of atmospheric regions workshop. So I did a lot of both ham radio and ionospheric science work while I was there. I worked with a few people, including Phil Erickson, who you all know, and Liz McDonald, who's the person who runs Aurorasaurus. We submitted a proposal that could potentially get the HAMSI effort some additional funding. If that goes through, it'd be rather a large win. So we'll see what happens there. I also gave a presentation on the September storms analysis using the RBN and WhisperNet data. And I also gave a presentation, a poster presentation, using SDR recordings from simultaneously from Antarctica and West Orange, New Jersey, monitoring CHU. And so that's probably the most similar thing to what we would be doing with the personal space weather station, the SDR, one of the most similar things. So I've been working on that. And I also made some recordings, SDR recordings of field day this weekend. So I'm working on processing some of that right now. And my colleague, Gareth Perry, he had the EPOP satellite listen to some of the field day channels as well this weekend. So we're going to try and do some analysis with that. So that's it with what we've done this past week. The other thing is I've recruited some of the other scientist hams, including Phil and Gareth and Ethan and Steve Kepler. And we're going to try and join the Tangerine SDR group on a rotating basis. So there should be at least one scientist logging in and checking into the group every week, sometimes maybe more than one, but we're hoping to have at least one scientist ham log in every week. Back over to you, W2NAF.
Okay, thank you, Nathaniel. I have my audio back, so I can be a little more intelligent about this. And moving down the list, Tom, N5EG is next. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dan, and thank you very much. Not too busy this week. Thanks to Dave for posting information on the Tometer. I was able to download all of the data sheets. And I haven't looked if it has a schematic, but it's a pretty complete set of information. So that's real. And the rest of it was tied up mostly with field day. So.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tom. Moving right along and going back to the top of the list, Scotty, WA2DFI, have you recovered yet?
No, I'm not recovered. Spent the whole week getting ready and spent the weekend doing field day. So it's pretty intense. We had about 15 people and made, I think, 1,063 QSOs. I did get the chance to operate since we had kind of a skeleton crew this weekend. So I got to make over 300 CW QSOs, which is a fun thing. Haven't done that in a long time. Usually I get kind of curtailed operating, tried to keep everything moving. So it was a fun time, but it was tiring as usual. I think it'll be a few more days before I'm really recovered. So didn't really get much done this week, although had some interesting discussions at field day about configuring a station for an SDR station for field day. So it'll be interesting. The participants there were really excited about maybe using an SDR type station instead of and get this 30 some year old radios that we're using Kenwood TS50s. And I looked them up. They came out about 1988 or 89, and so some of them are pretty long in the tooth. And it seems like every year we have some dysfunction, either outright breakage or just degradation on the radio. So have to do that. But anyway, next week I want to get back to the protocol and flesh that out a little bit and get it up for people to look at. And I think Bill will be back next week, so maybe if he can take a look at that and show me the error of my ways, or say, okay, he thinks it'll work. And I guess the other people on here that are networking people that I'm not to set me straight in the right direction. And by the way, Dan, Mike isn't shown as muted or away, so you might want to say something, even though he is recording. And we thanks Mike for recording and posting audios. Back over to you, Dan. Oh, now you've got no audio, Dan. Okay, well, let me just ask Mike directly. Did you want to say something, Mike? Okay, I'm not getting any audio either, so maybe it's on my end. Anyone else hearing audio?
I'm not hearing anybody either.
Yeah, I'm just hearing some microphone hum. Mike tries to talk.
I agree.
Well, now he's shown as muted in a way, so I guess that answers our question there. But if you get it fixed, Mike, come back in. You're welcome to chat. And how about you, Dan? Did you get yours fixed? Nope, still no audio. Well, anyway, that brings us to the end of the list. So I thank Dan for taking care of that, and I hope you can get your audio fixed soon. Seems like it just went out on you. So I guess we'll open it up to a general discussion now.
Okay, so my audio is back. I have this ancient USB headset, and it has like a little auxiliary on-off switch. And when you press it by accident, it still works. So I did want to make one additional comment. I got an Audible book last week that I've been listening to. I think I'm about 10 hours into a 12-hour reading of the book. And it's called Seeing in the Dark. And I don't know if Nathaniel might be aware of it. I was not. And the thread that runs through the whole book is how non-academics are helping astronomers, and kind of the backyard astronomer helping out the professional astronomer tale. And it really got me fired up about working on this project. It's quite good. And I would imagine a lot of people are into astronomy on a full-time basis, which I am not, whether it be amateur or professional, have either read or heard the book. There also was a PBS program called Seeing in the Dark that was out a few years ago that was kind of a takeoff on the basic concept that was presented in this particular book. And I also looked at that episode on PBS. I'm not sure. I don't know whether it was just a regular PBS series or exactly what it was, but it was quite good as well. So anyway, I did want to mention that for those who are listening. If you think you might be interested in doing something with this project and aren't sure, take a look or read or listen to Seeing in the Dark, and I think you'll change in a very positive way.
Thanks a lot. I haven't heard of that particular book before, but I'm looking up, and it does look very good. And I can say that the professional-amateur astronomy community is quite strong, probably much stronger than it is in radio or space science. But I know that, like, if you go to, well, I've been to the Northeast Astronomy Forum, they have a whole pro-amateur session. So there is a lot of work that the astronomers, the amateur astronomy community does to help professional astronomy group. So I think that's a really good model for us in the space and ionospheric sciences as well.
Yeah, I posted the link to Amazon down there for the book, because there's quite a few books of that title that have nothing to do with astronomy.
Yes, I noticed that. And actually, if you sign up for Audible Books and don't already belong to the regular club, I think for the first 30 days, if you remember to delete your account before the time is up into doing that, or if you just want to hold on to it, you can get two Audible books and each month. And this ought to obviously count for one of those. Otherwise, I think the Audible version of this thing is $28.
You can also buy a used one starting at 10 cents if you want a paper copy.
Yeah, I think it was actually in its original iteration a paper.
Yeah, because let's see, I'm seeing, including the shipping and all that, it's around $5. And here's one in very good condition for $5.06 free shipping, with free shipping. So I usually try to buy used ones when I can, because I mean, the words are the words, as long as it's not the binding's not broken, it's not run over, it's kind of got a history, you know. So and I know, I guess Audible books are good if you're driving around or that, but do you find it's easier to read the book or to use the Audible one?
Well, I think for me it was easier to use the Audible, because I have a problem with reading, and I start out, I get gung-ho, and then about halfway through the book I kind of lose interest and move on to something else, although I don't think I would have with this particular book. It's really very entertaining, and the author actually reads it, which is not completely unusual, but not common, and it's really well worth it, either as a written book or as a printed book or as a Audible book.
So do you know what the subscription cost is? Is it a monthly bill or an annual fee, or what do they do for the audiobooks?
My recollection is it's around $10, maybe a little each month. I kind of signed up, looked at it, and then made a mental note to unsubscribe. You can do it as part of your, in fact, it may even be a special deal with Amazon Prime right now.
Yeah, I looked on the page, and on Prime, it is free, but you have to sign up for the subscription. So it's not, I guess, technically not free.
Yeah, that's right. That was the way it worked. It was for Prime members. It was free for 1 month, and then when you forgot to unsubscribe after your month, before your month was up, it dinged you again automatically for another month.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I don't do those, because I'm so bad at remembering. I'll forget, and then by the time a year goes by, you'll realize that you still subscribe and you haven't even used the service.
Yeah, same here.
So I guess kind of a quiet week with Field Day taking up time, and Nathaniel, your conference and all that. I wanted to ask Nathaniel, have you seen I think it's the SARA conference this year. It's at Green Bank in August. Have you seen that?
Someone told me about it, but I haven't had a chance to go look at that.
Yeah, it's pretty
recent. Is anyone here going? Have you been to it?
No, I've never been to it. I think it's maybe the second one only, maybe there were other ones, but I've been looking back to see what the papers are like, but they hadn't posted anything yet. So it's hard to see what the topics are going to be like. The keynote is a guy talking about using radar to do planetary positioning or recording, or you know, using radar to investigate the planets. But that's the only speech I've seen. But it's like 3 days, so there's got to be lots of talkers, lots of speakers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm looking at the website now.
So they got any speakers up yet?
The plenary or the here, they have something for live streaming. Here's a tentative it just says to be announced soon. The tentative schedule is to be announced, so it doesn't look like it.
Yeah, it seemed pretty reasonable. The conference fees were only $165, and that includes all the meals, which is probably required because the place is out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I guess also, again, because it's Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. You know, it's similar to the ham radio stuff. It's not going to be as expensive as the professional.
Yeah, not like an IEEE conference.
Yeah, yeah. How much is IEEE?
Oh, I think it varies a conference.
Yeah, because the meeting I just went to was about, if you're a professional, it's about $520, the regular registration, and that includes one banquet.
And how many presentations are there? How many days is the conference? Is it just a weekend or like?
Oh, no, it's it's Monday through Friday.
So, wow, a whole week?
Yeah, it's a pretty packed, it's a pretty big deal. There's about 200 people that go. You have people from all over the world. And you have a lot of parallel sessions. So, and they actually have them, they have the conferences back to back. So the one I went to last was the one that focused on the ionosphere and, say, the upper atmosphere primarily. And next, the one that's happening this week is in the same place. That is the magnetosphere down to the upper atmosphere. So one is more lower atmosphere or middle and upper atmosphere, and the other one's like upper atmosphere and outer space. So it's like two back-to-back conferences, and then they have a joint session right in the middle. So it's very active.
Wow, with multiple tracks too, so you could always find something interesting.
Oh my gosh, yeah, and they have posters, and you know, some of you would probably be interested in going in the future. I know, you know, for instance, all the MIT Haystack people were there. There was a guy from the astronomy, radio astronomy observatory out in Ukraine, who is also monitoring CHU down in Antarctica from the Ukrainian station. And he showed me 9 years worth of Doppler shift data that he had on CHU from down in Antarctica. It's a really nice workshop.
Well, that sounds like it. Can you like post a link to that or something on the TeamSpeak or on the personal space station? Not on TeamSpeak, on the email list.
Yeah, I can send out the workshop link, put it here right now. And then on the email list, I can also send out the poster that I gave too. And I sent it out to the main HAMSCI list. We had a HAMSCI breakfast there as well. We had 9 people show up, so it was well attended.
All right, that sounds really good. Always looking for more interesting places to go and get more information. And speaking of that, did you see Mike's question down there in the text?
Is that for me?
Anyone.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. The only downside with those is they're expensive, but they're certainly not as expensive as a MagLoop. The plus side of them is that they're high quality. They have the proper bandwidth, and they are, you know, readily available.
Now, Mike, can you post the part number of the antenna, the model number? These are just whips, though, so I haven't seen them. But they're expensive.
I think they're about 300. They change.
I guess
part
most
number.
That goes in. That goes into the active antenna part, the amplifier, right?
Yeah, it's the active vertical receive antenna. No, they just part number on. I think they used to be called the ARAV3. I'm trying to find the updated link. Yeah, okay, now it's the ARAV4. So I think this is what I'm talking about. Now I know that Ethan uses these. He actually puts it in a cross dipole configuration. So he gets two of them. He does a cross dipole, and that allows you to do the polarization receive. But as I said, this is expensive. That's the downside of it. But in terms of
a group buy or something.
Yeah. In terms of like a high quality commercial off the shelf product that has the right specifications, I think this would be a very strong candidate.
But I'd think at $350, you could certainly make one, much less than that. Maybe it would be another project.
So you could list this as an antenna that would be usable and then say, or we can build something that would have equal performance for less if you wanted to put it together yourself.
Exactly.
You know, this is Tom. Quick question. How does Phil change listen polarizations?
Ethan, so what he does is he'll take one of those preamplifiers and he will he'll actually get two whips. And so he'll make basically a dipole on one. And then he'll take a second preamplifier and make it a dipole in the other direction. And they're horizontal. He puts the whips horizontal instead of vertical.
Okay. So he's hatching a case of amplifier.
Yeah. Let me see if I have a picture. I'll look for a picture, but I think half of it too. That sounds about right.
Okay. Very good.
That's $700 of antenna.
Yeah. So I think, as I said, in terms of specifications and design, I think it's the right thing. But in terms of performance or in terms of cost, I don't think it's right. Okay, yeah, I have here. You can take a look at what he did here. On the bottom of this article is a slideshow. And if you jump to the slide that says Ethan's CODAR antenna, you can see a picture of it. And again, this would be, if you're putting it in that configuration, that's certainly for more of a power user sort of configuration.
Okay, interesting. I hadn't considered using it as a dipole.
I mean, certainly with a vertical whip, you're able to get omnidirectional reception. You're able to make Doppler shift measurements on things like WWV and CHU. You're able to pull in, you are able to pull in CODAR signals and do do RBN and Whisper and all that stuff. But if you put it in this horizontal dipole configuration, you then do get the polarization. I'll be back in 1 minute.
Okay, so Tom, I wasn't quite clear. It says, arranging it as a dipole connected the way you said, how do you get polarization out of that?
Well, typically you use it as a small active dipole instead of a magnetic loop. It's just a dipole. And if you have two of them at right angles to each other, then signals coming down from you can, were to phase the resolve circular position.
Okay, so you make a dipole, but it's in an angle instead of in line?
Yeah, the dipole is horizontalized. So the antenna, I think, from DX Engineering was intended to be vertically polarized, so you tip it over. The whip is horizontal and counterpoise, I guess, or the other side poles connect. So that forms a horizontal dipole, one, say, pointed north, south, and east, west.
Well, okay, so it's a dipole, but it's bent at an angle then. So they're both parallel to the ground, but one goes north, south, and one goes east, west. And your dipole is, you know, instead of a straight dipole, it's a half and half.
No, it's a dipole. The slide that Nathaniel presented a link to, slide 8, shows a picture of it. It looks just like a dipole that's about 15.
Okay, but like I said, then if they're in line, then how do you get polarization?
They're not in line. One of the dipoles is point north south. The other dipole, for example, east west.
Oh wait, now so you're talking two dipoles? So that's like four antennas.
No. The slide shows then is take one whip antenna, and he is then attaching a second case, and then turn. And so instead of the whip is the other half of it is a piece of attached to the case.
Oh, okay. So he makes, rather than have two of them, I see. So it's not like two verticals with separate amplifiers hooked in like a buddy pole configuration where they put one vertical on one side, one vertical on the other. He just extends it out with a piece of wire.
No, right. I think there are two separate amplifiers there. I know there are two amplifiers there. One is on top and one is on the bottom. On the one on the bottom, he has one whip extending from one side of the amplifier and one whip extending from the other side of the amplifier. So I think it is like the buddy pole configuration, but attached to one of these preamps. So two preamps and four whips.
Okay, so that was my question. He has them at 90 degrees, so he has a cross set of dipoles then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
that's
now
right.
I understand right. How you can do it. I'm trying to figure out how you can do it with only one dipole.
It's two cross dipoles.
Right, but there's
okay. So I say it takes one. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a total of two amplifier. The entire amplifier, for example, northwest. The north south dipole. The other amplifier module is for the west.
Yes, one amplifier is for the north south dipole, and the other amplifier is for the east west dipole.
And then to make a dipole, he takes the vertical, turns it over flat, and then extends an equivalent number of feet out with another whip on the other side connected to the case.
Right. That's right.
And that works very well then?
Yeah, he uses it at a number of sites. Yeah, he's been quite happy with this design.
Looks like he has it on a mast. It looks like maybe a 20-foot mast.
That's about right.
So since they're active antennas, does it have a magic T or something where you supply power up the feed line?
Yes. Yeah. They use a bias T to power the feed. And what's nice is all of this, DX Engineering does have it pretty well documented on their product page there. So you can just click on the documentation tab, and they have their instruction manual, which has diagrams and explains all the wiring.
Yeah, I was looking on the site to see if you might be able to buy the amplifier separately if you homebrew your own antenna.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. The box they're showing there is the bias T. The amplifier is actually mounted on the base, at the base of the antenna, it looks like.
Yeah, so the bias T stays in the shack. The amplifier is at the base of the antenna.
Yeah, okay, and they actually show, in this configuration, there are two wing nuts. So they show one of the wing nuts connected to the ground, the mast clamp, but Ethan would just connect his to the other side of the antenna.
That's right.
Interesting, too, it covers down to 137 kilohertz band as well.
I think it depends on how you set the jumper configuration.
Oh, so it may not do all the full range 100 kilohertz to 30 meg all at once?
Right. There's a table in there. Let me find the page. Look at page 7.
What, of the manual?
That's right.
Nathaniel, where did where did you find the manual?
I went to the DX Engineering product page. I put a link to that there. And then there's a documentation tab, and you can download a PDF of the manual.
Okay, I'm still looking for the documentation tab.
It's halfway down the page next to the overview tab. It's kind of in the middle of the page.
Okay, thank you. I was looking for the tabs at the top. Got it.
Great.
It's interesting, though. It appears that the what they do is they have like a high pass filter in here. That's what the jumpers select, because it says generally you don't need to set the jumpers unless you're suspecting interference at some broadcast frequency.
Because the range of settings is. Yeah, so I guess by default, it says as shipped, all jumpers are deactivated for full frequency coverage.
Yeah, so then it says set the jumpers to the lowest frequency you're going to listen to. So I presume that all of them off, you get full coverage, and then you can set the low pass or the high pass knee at anywhere from about 1 megahertz to about 3 megahertz.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I built a homebrew active receive loop, and it's about, and I ended up having to put a tunable LC as a notch to take out AM broadcast stations. Instead of trying to filter like they do here, it's a tunable notch in the antennas, AM broadcast stations. That may be an additional option. You'd have to look at the schematic, see if there's possible.
Didn't you build two of those and mount them 90 degrees apart, or oriented 90 degrees?
Yes, I did.
I remember that from a DCC presentation you gave a while back.
Yeah, the advantage is, you know, it's a shockingly terrible looking. It was all constructed from home. Price tag was low.
I thought they were blue. Is that not right?
Yeah, I used it. They had some blue PEX tubing in 10-foot lengths, and so just tubes of PEX tube, you could stick the RGA as the...
Okay, so the loop was just mechanical, and then the blue was mechanical, blue tubing, and the antenna was the coax?
Yeah. Inside, the blue is just to protect it from the elements and hold it in the right position, and inside, shield for an inch. They each go into balanced, a pair of 2N51 balanced amplifiers.
Oh, okay. So a shielded loop. Yeah, I built a big one of those for 160. Used an MAR1 as an amplifier, and I could never get the amplifier to work right.
Yeah, I had some issues with it, and I've tracked it down to. I also put in the transfer, converted to single-ended transfer rejection choke, so they put it up on feed line, decouple it. Mike and I were going to try to do some AM station calibration. I've managed to find data on one of the transmitters near. I've estimated the field to see if my measurement data correlates well to the AM broadcast stations.
So are those field strength measurements public? They're published?
This one, there is a table on the FCC webpage where the broadcasters are supposed to put field strength, and some have it and some. I was cautioned to trust strong.
Oh, okay. So it probably wouldn't be reliable enough to... do what Mike was asking about reference. You know, pick a reference antenna and pick a broadcast station near you and calculate what the field strength should be or read it off the tables.
Yeah, I was going to try to run that test to see if I could get relation. Mike Pappas, who was at, sent a link to AM frequency field strength correction tape. About every 10 or 20 or 30 kilohertz, they have tables that show you how the field strength varies from linear. So normally, for example, the electric field vector ought to go as one of the distance. It's not exactly one over the distance, but it turned out in the frequency range I was in the distance, it was extremely close to.
So why wouldn't it be linear?
In theory, you know, if you're in free space, it will be linear. So the electric field, magnetic field, and the product of the two goes down R squared. So that gives you the R squared power relation because of surface radiation and a few other.
Yeah, one thing I was going to bring up too is that we talked about a noise source calibration, ability to inject noise into the antenna, or a SDR calibration feature. One thing that from someone has used these parts before is those. Are you familiar with the Peregrine semiconductor RF switches?
No, I'm not.
Well, they were used in some production radios, and the problem they had was since they operate in differential mode, or I don't know what you call it, but plus and minus power supply voltage, but externally they are single ended. They use a single 5-volt supply or a 3-volt supply. But the logic inside requires a bipolar power supply, so they have an inverting switching supply built into the part, and apparently on weak signals, you actually pick that up in the antenna on the pins that run through that you're switching. So if you've got a very sensitive receiver, you have a problem.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that. In my view, for some operation, difficult the properties of a...
Well, what I was thinking is if we could use, we could just leave it coupled all the time and use the output impedance, the powered down or the off output impedance of the noise source as part of the antenna input, matching or loading, whatever, and then just leave it connected all the time and turn it on and off. Would that be possible?
One would have to be careful the antenna itself to the noise source be spectrally shaped.
Oh, okay. And then if you want to disconnect the antenna while you're doing that, then you're back to the same old problem.
Yeah, so there's several orientation possibility converter from the source.
So you're going to have to basically disconnect the antenna and connect it to the noise source. You can't just inject the noise source because then you don't really know what impedance you're working against, right?
Right. Now, if the amplifier, if the receive signal amplifier, then you would know what the impedance is. Amplifier is feeding, and so I'm not sure what you'd be fighting noise source track feed.
And perhaps you could rig up some kind of mixer arrangement, but then you're not going to get just the noise source. You're going to get the input from the antenna unless you figure out a way to maybe short that or disconnecting it seems better.
Certainly, I would think it would be reliable from a measurement perspective.
It's hard to beat a relay for IMD performance.
Yeah, and at the frequencies that we're talking, only going up to 30 megahertz or so, it's adequate.
So what are you envisioning that we would use as a noise source?
I don't know. There, somebody pointed out a couple of noise sources were available. I haven't. They're apparently fairly common. Zener, the old timey was to bias up a Zener AC output of that into an amplifier.
It might be worth looking at what Radio Jove does. They use similar frequencies, and I know they have a procedure for noise source calibration. And they also, are a citizen science type of project.
And what radio was this?
It's called Radio Jove, J-O-V-E. It's another NASA project.
Yeah, the webpage is joe.gsfnasa.gov. Any rate, there are very inexpensive noise sources available on Amazon, and so those are, I think the circuitry is not too common.
Okay, what about the possibility of maybe just building a little dongle that you could plug onto the antenna, as in like a terminator, but instead it's a noise source?
Well, that's possible. I think Phil Erickson to be able to periodically inject noise, capture them from it, and then switch back so that once a week, once a month, I don't know that period, he wanted a processor role.
Yeah, so that would preclude you doing that with an external one. Although what you might do is you might have a noise source SMA on the board, an extra connector. And actually in that way, you could use that as a TR relay instead of a noise source relay if you programmed it that way.
Yeah, there's a number of possibilities for, Phil would just wanted to make sure that for any measurement campaign that he would be able to get data packets that correspond to noise so this could be analyzed, all the data, his central processing.
Yeah, so if you made a dongle or a little terminator type thing, you could actually hook it up to the SMA and just leave it on there all the time. And, of course, I guess you really wouldn't want it generating noise all the time. So you'd have to have some kind of control to it when that gets too gnarly.
Yeah, again, I get back to a relay is pretty simple.
Yeah, really. Well, I'm thinking of a relay, but a relay to a connector instead of a relay to a built-on-board noise source. And then you can plug your noise source onto the connector if you want, and you could leave it there. But the problem is you really don't want the noise source, even when the relay is unpicked, you don't want the noise source generating noise because it's going to couple into the antenna anyway through the relay, even though it might be, 60 dB down. When you're building a minus 140 dBm receiver, 60 dB is not much.
Yeah, I would assume you're off.
Yeah, so then we'd have to have like a bias T on the board, and you have to do that on the noise source. And you could do that, I guess, and that could be a separate accessory that you could buy if you wanted to use it. And you could use it on other equipment, too, because it's on a connector.
Yeah, I'm reading the manual that Nathan referenced that for you.
With this one on the DX Engineering antenna?
No. This is from the Radio Jove. There's a manual on use their noise source.
Oh, okay. I looked at that site, and it looks like there's a lot of stuff there. So how did you find that on the site?
I went to the site map page and found it. This one at site/tel/equip.
Another thing that's interesting is the Radio Jove project. It's a piece of software called Radio SkyPipe. And this was written by Jim Sky, and he's a ham radio operator. He interned at Dayton.
Oh, okay. I was looking at this manual. What does he do?
He wrote the SkyPipe software that the Radio Jove project used. So when you're reading the manual, like I'm looking at the document on there that says measuring antenna temperature, they talk about SkyPipe units. This is The Radio SkyPipe is Jim Sky's software.
Oh, okay. Very good. So did you get to talk to him at all?
Yeah, briefly. I didn't get to have an in-depth conversation, but he was quite friendly.
Yeah, I went over and talked to the Sarah guy there at the booth. He was just in the next room over from the HamSci booth at Hamvention. And he told me that one of the things that they're interested in doing is measuring emissions from pulsars.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So what he wanted was 100 megahertz bandwidth, like say, for instance, 1 gigahertz to 1.1 gigahertz. And what he wanted the software to do was to measure the energy content contained in that 100 megahertz. So process the IQ data for 100 megahertz wide and come up with a single number that represents the energy content of all of the signals in that bandwidth. And they want to average it over 5 minutes. So this is like a 5 minute one statistic reporting, which certainly would be within the bandwidth of our net connection.
Yeah, that would be really nice.
So I thought we could have an FPGA load that would do pulsar detection and it would just do that kind of reporting. Or in fact, maybe we could do all of that in the single board computer and just have the standard FPGA software.
That sounds good.
So that would open it up to a whole bunch of new audience of users.
Absolutely.
And then also, I didn't mention either, I talked to Ed Hare from the ARRL, and he said that they're looking at something that could be made portable that would be a noise sniffer. And he said currently the power companies, in order to do the noise sniffing, that what they want is they want to look at phase relationships between different frequencies. And I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying this, but what he basically said was that a noise source on a power line at its source generates a waveform that is wide band, many frequency components. And then, of course, the frequency components, their phases are not aligned as you travel down the wire because they're on different frequencies, so their wavelengths are different. But he says if you can receive the interference coming off the line and look at the different frequencies and compare their phases, you can basically tell where the noise source is by looking at the point where all of the phases are equal.
Okay, that's pretty clever.
Anyway, he says if you could make a system like that for under $600, which is certainly in our price range, he says you could probably sell them to the power companies because currently they have very sophisticated, expensive equipment to do that, and they'd love to have a handheld SDR unit that could sniff out arcs and intermittents on power lines.
Right, that makes sense. And at least within, I mean, that's, you know, if we're going to have a super stable oscillator on here, we should be able to make those kind of measurements, I think.
Yeah, and it probably doesn't even have to be that sensitive if you're in close proximity to the lines.
Yes, true.
So the idea would be you could use a small antenna and you probably wouldn't need, maybe not even much of a preamp on it.
Right.
Anyway, I was hoping to talk to him about it because he was talking about maybe ARRL helping us publicize this a little bit. But so far he hasn't been returning my emails. So I don't know, maybe he was caught up in the excitement of Hamvention. Or maybe he's on vacation now. We'll see if I can get in touch with him.
And there was field day, too.
And there was field day. And, you know, he's pretty active ham, so he's busy a lot of the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was not able to find a schematic for the Noise Generator Radio Jove site. I'm doing some other web searches. I could find a few that use the classic biases to amplify them.
I don't know what other. So what we'd have to do is we'd have to calibrate the noise source then when we built it on the board.
Yeah, I don't know what the spectral content, you'd be worried, you know, the noise source would put out one frequency less at another. The A to D, I think, is going to be good. And so from the, you know, cat to measure what the noise source, just you can do an FF on what comes out of it. And then I don't know, you know, I would hope that in production, all of them are going to be the same, going to be relatively the same. You may run into a problem of having to calibrate the calibration.
Yeah, I mean, we can do that in production, but then, of course, you worry about how often is the calibrator going to have to be calibrated.
Yeah, it's one of those things, characterization. You characterize the circuit and know within some certain bounds how it's going to be in production, or do you have to measure each one?
But wouldn't you think, though, that from the A to D converter outward, or inward, I guess, from our FPGA and DSP software point of view, that's going to not really change over time, right? I mean, it's going to be stable, more stable than the analog noise source is going to be.
Yeah, That's where we get into, can we characterize it? So if we know that the amplifier feeding is very stable, I don't expect the noise around too much. You know, so once you know it's a response, it doesn't change much. If it were to change, the AD would tell you. And if you capture actual packet data from the A to D converter while it's listening to noise source, it in fact see variation frequency. But then the second question would be, does the noise source change its amplitude over time? If its amplitude went up and down over time, over temperature, you know, hard thing to find out.
Well, I mean, I got to ask, but what exactly are we calibrating on a receiver? Because we're going to have a step attenuator and an amplifier, and then all digital. So you're actually calibrating the analog input to the ADC, as well as the amplifier and the attenuator, and that's it, because everything else is digital. So that doesn't really require calibration, right?
Yeah, you can ask Phil where his concern. I think in the past they have had.
Yeah, I know PowerSDR has the ability to inject a specific level of signal and calibrate their calculation of signal strength and dBm to that. So if you use like a XG1 from an Elecraft XG1, you have a 50 microvolt output, and you know it's calibrated 50 microvolt output. But it's a signal, it's not noise, then you can calibrate, you can tune the radio to that and calibrate that way. But it's, all you're doing is you're calculating the difference between what your known injection is in and the digital values that you get out of the ADC, right? So it's just calibrating, it's measuring the analog circuitry on the front end of the radio and characterizing it and storing that away.
Yeah, if anything were to change that path, if the A to D converter had some power supply dependency or temperatures or the components in front of it, that would be to catch that. Those things move around completely well known, you may be able to characterize them just as well as a noise generator. What you say is correct.
Okay, I see, because you can do this, the noise generator, you can measure it at different frequencies.
Yeah, it puts out broadband noise. So if you noise out, you then just take the output data, you run it into a fast forward, get the spectrum. It ought to be, you know, if it's a white noise source, it'll noise spectrum.
But is there really such thing as a flat noise spectrum like that?
Well, it'll be some reasonable approximation. No error with things with capacitors. You may have some filters in front of the order, so there'll be some modified.
Yeah. So I think the only filter we're planning is a low pass filter. And except, of course, in your case, you're talking about that optional filter, so you could put pretty much anything that you wanted to build in there.
Yeah, I am concerned about AM broadcast station interfering in my homebrew loop. It is a signal. I do have to notch.
But that's just a simple LC or an RC, probably LC. So can you put a couple notch filters, cascade them on a small board?
On my loop, I put two LC in between the collectors of the diff amp, notches out the AM station enough to a third order. But, they're notch in. Fortunately, I found some high tunable inductor. They're basically screwdriver adjustable. The difficult tower 1 mile away from me, three cast stations on 20.
Oh, nice. So you have to have three separate notches or just, and it's really, if we want to do a long wave stuff, we can't just put a high pass filter on it.
Yeah, so I think one of the options for the filter, a band stop filter, where you can take out, you know, from 500 hertz to 1.5 hertz or something. I put in two LCs, which is about as much as I get without them to each other. And unfortunately, two isn't enough.
Yeah, and a band stop filter, I mean, you probably don't even need more than 10 dB, right?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a huge amount. On mine, I could get the notch dB down or something, and if I take two of the stations, it makes a big improvement. So, but you can do non-tunable components, just fixed components, a stop, which for most fought to solve.
Yeah, because I know a buddy of mine has used the HF1 that we build that has no filters in it. It has a low-pass filter, but nothing in the broadcast band. He lives 1 mile away from a 5 kW station. And between 3 and 5 dB is all he needs to make sure it never saturates. And he's 1 mile away.
Yeah, I don't know what the characteristics of its entering amplifier, what the overload point of the A to D converter is on the receiver. And so it may not need to be huge. With the adjustable notch, it was that station, go down in amplitude, so at the same cast stations.
Yeah, I think I measured the overload of RHF1 at... is it minus 11 dBm, I want to say? Does that sound right?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm booted up in Windows right now, and I've got my data for the number of millivolts I'm on the Linux system. I went and did a field strength calculation and amplifier, the loop's responsivity, you know, how many volts meters long is the loop equivalent amplifier, the estimate was going to be, and it's in the millivolts range.
Yeah, I think, okay, so we have a 20 dB amplifier and we have a 30 dB attenuator, but so the attenuator limit is about 3 volts on the input. And so if you keep it under 3 volts and you turn the attenuator up to 31 dB, now, I mean, you've got, so that would be easy to overload the ADC at 0 dB, but because you got 20 dB amplifier, okay, so that's 10x, right? So that would be 300 millivolts at the input of the amplifier would saturate the 3 volt input of the AC. So between the attenuator and the amplifier, you have 300 millivolts maximum, and then you got 30 dB less than that. Oh, that's way low. Okay, so it's really it's the 3 volt saturation point of the attenuator that's the problem.
Yeah, you may. I did an analysis of the levels there in my ham site, which I think is on .com website. I'm not sure. I didn't get to those during the presentation, but I looked at the amp, the chain, the ADC driver, which is then looked at. There's a couple of different full scale signal ranges that you can program to, one or two value. You're in millivolts, somewhere 100 millivolts or something at the input to the ADC driver you start to choose.
Okay, and you said this is the slide deck that you had. I don't see it on here because I don't think we have slides up. We have just the videos.
Okay, let me take a look and see if I can find it. If not,
okay, that would be great. Yeah, because that's always a concern to and kind of try to match things so you don't end up with way more headroom in one stage and not enough in another.
Okay, well, yeah, it looks it looks like it's just the videos, not the actual slides. I'll email you.
Okay, it's less than 10 meg, isn't it?
I hope so.
Yeah, if it isn't, you won't be able to mail it to me because I think 10 meg is my limit. But we got to have those up somewhere, like on the Tapper site or this was at DCC or at the HAMSI meeting?
This is the slide deck for the HAMSI.
Okay, well, aren't those up somewhere, Nathaniel?
Yeah, those are on the website. I'll send you, if you go to the agenda, you just click his title at the agenda. And the slide will come up. I'll post the link on the TeamSpeak.
Okay, great. So, yeah, so Tom, you don't have to send it to me. I'll get it there. That's easier.
Okay, that'll at least give you, it's a theoretical calculation, but it shows you the maximum levels and kind of where things points in the receiver.
Okay, good information. And before I forget, Nathaniel, did you say you recorded Field Day, some broadband recordings?
Yeah, I have that. I have almost all of it on 80 on 160, 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10.
Oh, you're my hero. Do you think I could get a copy of at least a 20 meter one? I know it's huge, so I don't know how we would do it. A Dropbox, maybe?
Yeah, the total recording is about 750 gigs. So I guess 20 meter should be about 1/6 of that. I can't do it this week, but next week I could figure out a way to post it for you.
Okay, the thing is, and I'll tell you the reason I needed it, okay, is we had some new people at Field Day this weekend, and the problem that I'm trying to solve here is they don't have any experience tuning SSB, and you can't get on the band during a regular time and tune SSB very easily. What you really need is a contest where there's wall-to-wall people, and you're trying to teach them how to search and pounce, tune up the band, and pick out stations and work them. And so if I could get a recording I could play back, then I could actually... it would be an actual real live Field Day exercise and they could practice here without the contest. And so I really don't need like 24 hours of it. I mean, I need a half hour's worth.
Okay. Can I get it? I'm going on vacation tomorrow. So can I work with you to get it to next week sometime?
Oh yeah. No problem at all for the time frame because we're off this next week resting. And then our first meeting will be, I think, July 2nd. And, you know, even if I don't have it for that, it's okay. If I know it's coming, I can get things set up and we can have some training sessions, which I'm sure they would love because they don't like being thrown into the fire, you know, with no experience at all.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Now, I have it recorded in the MIT Digital RF format. So I guess this will be a good opportunity to play around with that format. Getting it to play back, you can certainly get it to play back in GNU Radio. And then what you do with it from there... I'm not sure.
So what bandwidth did you record? What simultaneous bandwidth?
192 kilohertz.
Okay, because I've built a receiver in GNU Radio at for 384, so I could tweak that maybe and just feed it into there. Now, do I need a special source block to do that?
I think so, but that's available on GitHub.
Okay, so that would be an exercise in itself to get that up and going. Because okay, so I can do that. You know, what do you think would be involved in getting it? I don't know what format HDSDR uses to store data, but if maybe we see if we can, I can write a program to do a conversion.
Yeah, typically GNU Radio, if you just stream to a file sync, it just stores, if you're sending real numbers to it, it's just floating point. It'll be four consecutive bytes, and Python knows.
So it would just be I and Q interleaved and floating point numbers?
Well, it depends. You know, it depends if it's complex. You stream, then it would be, you know, 4 bytes I, 4 bytes Q, 4 bytes I, 4 bytes Q in that format. If you stream real, that would just be.
It'd be really nice if we could get someone to make a nice, easy interface between this MIT Digital RF format and a format that the software-defined radios can receive, like the Kiwi SDR front end or GQRX or something like that, to give a nice, easy front end for a browsing the digital RF files.
Yeah.
Well, if we could make it.
Go ahead, Scotty.
I was going to say, if we could make a non-real time converter, then couldn't you just play read the file in and spit out the format that one of these other radios could use? Would that be acceptable, or would you want to do like a real time conversion?
Well, I think for right now, what you want to do, doing the file is fine. For the more distant future, having a way of reading it into in real time would be really nice, but that's a bigger project.
Okay, so Nathaniel, this is Tom. I'm giving a workshop on GNU Radio later this year, and I need a small snippet recorded band spectrum from one example in the students. Do you have a small version of those available? It needs to be or two.
Yeah, I could get some to both of you guys. I believe it'd be too much trouble.
Okay, that would be a great help. I unfortunately operated field day instead of recording it, so that would be a tremendous help.
Sure, no problem. The fastest thing for me to do will probably just post all of the files, which I should be able to do, but then hopefully I can figure out a way to get you guys a subset of that, so it's easier to pass around and play around with.
Yeah.
Well, there's no packetization, right? So can't you just, you know, DD one block up and to a smaller file, or does it have to be smarter than that?
I think no, everything, it's all broken up into individual files. I think every file is 1 second long, so I just have to give you the right number of files. The thing I'm not sure about is there are some additional metadata files. I don't know if I just give you the metadata files, if I can just copy them directly, or if I have to regenerate them. That I'm not sure about. But the file structure is one directory for every band, and then within each of those band directories, there's an HDF5 file for every minute, either every minute or every second.
Well, so Tom, that would be pretty easy then to just grab the right kind of right number of files, as long as you could not break the metadata.
Yeah, I don't know how it separates out. I think the metadata was in the data files themselves were in a different merged together.
Yes, that's right. There is a separate metadata director. And I guess what I'm not sure is if I can. I think I can. I think I can just take the subset of data files and still just copy over the metadata file metadata directory, and I think that will be fine. But I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, for my purpose, I just the data portions, you know, put together a bit or two's worth of data, and wouldn't need to know exactly what's attached to for Scott.
Yeah.
And for my use, I don't need any metadata because I just want the audio.
Yeah, I'll see. I might be able to send you guys a Google Drive link sooner than next week. I'll see what I can get going here.
Okay, very helpful. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. That would be great.
Yeah, my recollection is with PowerSDR, we used Windows Media Auto audio for our lossless file format.
So that's a WMA file?
Exactly.
But is that the file format broadband 182 hertz audio spectrum?
It's for the radio spectrum.
Okay.
So they refer to digital RF 1.0 and digital RF 2.0, Nathaniel. Is that just, what's the difference between those?
I don't know. I think I'm using
Okay. Oh, yeah. Here it says right here, RF 2.0 uses subdirectories and files with predictable names. So that sounds like what you described.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And that's certainly a nice feature.
And you say there is a source block in GNU Radio to read this format?
Yes, and I've used that.
Yeah, the writer works as well. I've updated to the 2.6 now, and it seems to work very well.
So we could actually just build a GNU Radio pack to do the conversion right in GNU Radio, and that's it.
Yeah, if the reader works, the GNU Radio flow graph would be.
And we could probably even write something out. Do you think we could write WMA files out? We can do that kind of conversion with the blocks available in GNU Radio?
I don't know if there is a WMA file converter.
Yeah, we might be able to build one.
I think there are a number of file converters that are available. With WMA or with FLAC, either one, you can convert that to just about any format you want.
Hey, Dan, do you know what HDSDR uses on their recorder?
No, I don't. I think they use WMA, but I'm not positive about that.
Okay, so I've got some recordings on another computer. I can go look at them and see what suffix they have anyway. And so if we could write something out from GNU Radio that would be readable by HDSDR, that would be a real big benefit. In fact, we could build multiple converters. So finally, a underlying important reason to get GNU Radio loaded and running on a PC here. This PC, Dan, I don't know if I told you, it's an XPS 13, but I put a bigger SSD in it, and now I have a dual boot Linux system, Linux and Windows.
Oh, nice. I actually have GNU Radio running on a Raspberry Pi, believe it or not, on a 3.
Oh, my goodness. What kind of performance do you get?
You know, I don't know. I haven't really tasked it very much, but it compiled fine. And, I mean, it starts up and runs fine. And I did, like, just a little bit of work with it. I didn't do anything heavy duty, but it seems to work reasonably well.
I should send you my AM radio flow graph and see if it runs on there.
Okay, you can do that.
Do you have an IQ2?
I do.
Okay, or are you still? Oh, I guess this runs on an HF1. So I think that, but I think IQ2 will produce that same format. It's the native SDR stick format that it takes as input.
Okay, yeah, I don't have an HF1. I do have an HF2.
HF2 would work because you could get the same format. I think an IQ2 would work also because it does either Hermes or native format.
Okay, yeah, I could take a look at it and see. Would be a real test for it. It'd be a real test for the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I could give you data at, see, for an HF2, I think it's 2.9 megahertz bandwidth of data, or 3.9 is pretty big.
Yeah, that's a pretty big chunk for the Raspberry Pi, I think. But it might work.
Well, I can also give it to you at 384K, which Pi HPSDR seems to be able to handle just barely.
Yeah, I think it probably could handle the 192K.
Scotty, I just sent the official.
Okay, so in your opinion, if I was to actually do this, is it easier doing this than doing it under Linux?
In Windows, there are binary installers, so it's MSI file, MSI, and click open.
And it installs Companion also?
Yeah, it's the whole package.
So this sounds like it might actually be easier than Trey, because the problem I have with Linux is that, with the different versions of different packages and different dependencies, sometimes GNU Radio barfs on you and won't run.
Yeah, that's why I'm given the class using Windows. I've installed it on my Windows Linux. It's like installing, it brings in all of the dependencies with it, so you don't need to worry about that. It comes up and runs.
Well, if that works, that's going to be a boon to GNU Radio developers.
Well, take a look at the link and give it a try. It was about a 5-minute exercise.
Oh, that's awesome. And now if I have a flow graph that I wrote under Linux, it should run the same, right? Because it's just Python code, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a GRC file, so it's just Python code. You can you have to make sure that all the modules you need are available. Because Windows has one of the problems with Windows is you are stuck with the radio person who decided to support.
By stuck with the radios, how do you mean? You mean the source blocks that are there?
Well, the guy who wrote the package put in the Edis radio, a couple of the other ones. He put in about 10 or so of the very common radios. But for example, OpenHPSD.
So what exactly is he putting in to support those? I'm not following too closely.
Well, source blocks.
Right. So if you have, for example, if you have and plug the Edis radio to the computer, there's a source block and a sync in the flow radio, so you can stream sample in from.
So it's source blocks. I see. So like the source block that you wrote for HPSDR is not in there, correct?
Right. Because it's not enough power with his trouble to install.
So what do you have to do to add that?
You don't do it under Windows.
Oh, so it has to be compiled in, and so you're out of luck then.
Yeah, that's right. On Linux, you can add modules fairly easily because he's gauge processed modules.
Oh, bummer. So that really lets me out, because if your module's not there, I'm not going to be able to use the source block I use in the flow graph that I can send to you, Dan, is something that Charlie wrote, so it wouldn't be in the Windows version either.
No, I know that. It's a gr-sdr stick. Yeah,
but we can certainly do the... Go ahead.
Oh, that was the one that I took a shot at when we went from one version of GNU Radio to the other, and it broke the module.
Oh, okay. So this one only runs... His only runs at the earlier version, right? With the earlier version, what, 3.7, I want to say?
No, it runs with the latest version of GNU Radio in Linux. It does not run in Windows, as Tom explained. It's kind of a different process for integrating the source blocks into Windows. So.
Right, okay. But we could still use the Windows version to do our file conversions, because those blocks probably are all there, those sources sync, all the file converters and the source blocks are all there.
Well, I don't know if they have the digital RF. So.
I would somewhat doubt that.
Okay, so that's not even going to work for my file converter, so I'm going to end up having to use Linux. I would like to try it, though, so if you're doing that, I'll look at this page and see if I can load it on a Windows machine. I mean, because the look and feel is going to be exactly the same for the blocks that they do have.
Yes, it is. I've used it. I'm the example ass on those machines. It runs just like...
So to add additional blocks, is it a simple matter of modifying the installer to include them, or do you have to actually... go in and recompile major pieces of it to put the hooks in to get these modules installed?
The source block software actually has the install profile in it. So when you compile the source block in Linux, and I guess in Python actually, it automagically decides where files go.
Right, but I'm talking about if we wanted to make this possible in Windows, I hear it's hard. What's involved?
That process is apparently complicated. I remember reading some of the threads on the mail list, and it was difficult enough that this one elf, he just made I recall some discussions that trying to modify it is very difficult.
So this is akin to like releasing a Linux distro then. So I take it that if you can recompile a source block under Windows, then there's a whole bunch more steps to integrate it in than there are under Linux.
I think so. I took a look at a little bit of the Windows structure, and there are some different files that you have to create. And I attempted to bring in an out-of-tree module into it, missing that seemed.
Okay, so maybe dependencies that you would normally satisfy under Linux, but you didn't satisfy under Windows, so it didn't.
I think it's part of the build process. There were a lot of discussion lists, people trying to get it to Windows, and all I could say is I sensed from reading the list the frustration level was high.
Yeah, I'm looking at this chart on that link that you sent me. Oh my. See, look at all the modules there are and who uses them. That just coming up with this chart must have taken him a while.
Yeah, he had to build and port over to Linux all of the support modules that it runs in. It's, as you can see from the page, there's a lot of them.
See, so he supports AirSpy, Blade RF, Hack RF, RTL SDR, Osmo SDR, and that's all I see right offhand.
And UHD at a small.
Yeah, the UHD also. But okay, you know, I might go down and just buy an AirSpy. They're not very expensive. Okay, well, I guess we run quite over our typical hour, so I think I'm gonna take off here, and thanks everyone for coming by. We will reconvene next week, and hope Dave is okay.
Oh, very good. Scotty, could I ask you to take block diagram module in the specification?
Oh, yeah, I did that after the last TeamSpeak last week. It looks pretty good, but I want to go over it and turn it over in my head a few times, and I'll make some comments.
Okay, very good.
And I'm trying to upload the files right now to Google, but I think it's just too big, so it may have to just wait until next week.
All right, no hurry from my.
Yeah, no hurry here. I don't burden yourself with it if you're getting ready to go on vacation.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Be like field day prep, right? Getting everything done in time.
Exactly.
So I shouldn't ask this question online, but when does the transition happen to your new digs?
Oh, no, you can ask. Let's see. So we're supposed to be moving to Scranton at the beginning of August. So somewhere between August 1st to August 5th. And classes begin August 26th.
Okay, and you're probably going to have a full load of classes, huh? Since it's more emphasis on the teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. Digital signal processing course, Physics 1 lab, and computer engineering lab.
Oh, wow. You're going to have some fun.
Absolutely.
So how does the grant work now that you're moved to somewhere else? Does it come back to you or does it come back to NJIT?
A little bit of both. It'll go back to NJIT, but then we'll redo the budget so it'll come back to me. And I'll leave some of it at NJIT as appropriate because NJIT will have certain resources that Scranton doesn't. And so we'll just renegotiate it if it comes through.
So then you'll still be the PI, right?
That's right.
Okay, sounds good. Well, good luck on your move. That's a big change.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And, you know, we're getting ready. I think the hardest thing right now is there's just so much to do and so little time. But, you know, we'll make it.
Yeah, really. August will be here before you can blink.
I know. Absolutely. But it'll be fine. All right. I'm going to get to bed here. So it was great talking with you guys. So, and I should talk to you next week. I think Gareth will be on next week. And then we'll start a rotation with the different scientists coming on.
Okay. Sounds great.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your time, too. Thanks for all the links. Those have all been helpful.
Oh, you're welcome. And thanks for all the work you guys are doing. This is great.
Yeah, we're going to have a good time here, I can tell.
All right. 73, guys.
73. Bye.